Cheryl and I lived in Pasadena when we were married, and we had a rental house. And rentals in Pasadena were expensive. This was an ad that she saw at work where she was working then in publishing, and it was a lady who wanted to rent her house to a church member because she felt that it would be then well cared for. It was an older home built around 1920 and had very little electrical service to the house. I mean, it had electrical service, but you had to be careful what things you plugged in because you could very easily blow the fuse. Anyway, the time came when the campus, the church at that time, bought one of the adjoining properties to the campus, and it was an apartment structure, and so they were going through to remodel it, and one of the men there that was responsible for that mentioned to us, there's a dishwasher in one of the apartments. If we're getting rid of these things, we're hauling out the old equipment, if you're interested, you can have it. Well, we didn't have a dishwasher. We'd never had a dishwasher, and we thought that was pretty nice. So we went up there, picked up the dishwasher, brought it back to the house. We installed it, and, you know, we were in tall cotton. We had a dishwasher, and you couldn't plug in a curling iron, but, you know, you could run the dishwasher. Well, when we were moved out of Pasadena, we were sent to Boise. And so one thing we wanted when we were looking for our apartment, we ended up renting part of a duplex, but we wanted to make sure we still had a dishwasher. We were used now to a dishwasher, and we expected to find one where we were going. Well, what was really interesting is the new place we got not only had a dishwasher, it had a self-cleaning oven. You know, and we thought, yes, you know, self-cleaning oven. You put it on, fries all that grease and splatter, you know, smokes the house. You get done with it all, and you wipe it up, and you're finished. Well, that house at some point had a little bit of a problem. The plumbing in the floor, it was actually a cement slab floor. A California contractor had built it in Boise, and the plumbing broke and flooded the house. And we literally had to flee the house. It was filling up with water, and had to move out and find a new place. Well, the new place had a dishwasher, self-cleaning oven, and a garage door opener. You know, that was nice. And so we got used to the garage door opener as well. So when we transferred then to Omaha, you can imagine the list is starting to grow. You know, we're getting used to the benefits of this society. The house in Omaha had a dishwasher and a self-cleaning oven and a garage door opener, and it had a built-in microwave. Now, we had a little kind of microwave you put on a stand, and we carried it with us, but this one had a built-in. So we now had two microwaves. And we used them both. We thought that we had arrived, you know, in two microwaves. But over the years, we got used to having certain things. We now have an electronic stove, not one of them chintzy old regular ones. We have an electronic stove. It's full of circuit boards inside this stove. And that's really interesting. Well, I'd say we used to have electronic stove. This last week, after Michelle came home from her surgery, I was cooking a pot of mushrooms on the stove, the dehydrated ones, and you put them in some soy and water, soy sauce, and of course, I'm multitasking, and I'm not a woman, and so I'm running up and down the stairs, checking on Michelle, cooking on the stove, answering the phone, writing a sermon, you know, communicating with whatever, and they boiled over, and they boiled over for a while. It took me a while to get back and remember that I was working on the stove and fried the circuit boards in the stove. Now, she came home. She had surgery on Thursday. This would have been Friday. Thanksgiving, we have 12 people coming, and we no longer have an oven. And, of course, everyone knows what you do for Thanksgiving. You have to have an oven. So I figured, well, okay, this is a problem. I figured in my mind what it would cost to just call the appliance store, have them send a truck with a serviceman, look at my stove, figure out how many parts had been fried, charge me for the trip, the truck, the time, go order the parts, bring them back in overnight express, and then come and install them, and I'd have to take out a second mortgage on the house. So Derek and I pulled the stove apart and cleaned it all up best we could. There were some error messages that posted on that stove in the process of dying, and I had wrote them down and checked them out, and so we needed one of the circuit boards. Ordered it overnight, I think the delivery charge was $80 for overnight delivery, but hey, Thanksgiving's coming. I've got to be able to cook a turkey in the oven. There was a storm in Seattle, apparently. It never even arrived overnight, but you still pay for the effort, right? You pay for the good intentions of having shipped out this circuit board. Anyway, so far, I have spent, it's a budget for us both, but so far we've spent $226.29, and the only thing that I've managed to repair is now the clock. The clock works on the stove. We still don't have an oven. There's the keypad. There's some other circuit boards. There's the connecting ribbon cable. There's a few more things that might possibly need to be done. You know what? That's a problem. But it's not a problem because we have little. It's a problem because we have much. When you have an electronic stove that costs more to repair than the stove you owned before that, I could have gone and bought a used stove for $200 and stuffed it in the slot, and we'd have had an oven. That would have been just sufficient. But the problem we have is not that we have little. The problem we have is that we have not much. We need to keep this life, brethren, in perspective. These are the good times. The hard times are the times to come. You know, whatever troubles we have, whatever struggles there are, these are the good times. We need to keep that in perspective. In my office, I have a set of posters from the Challenger 2 programs. We didn't do a poster every program, but at some point, we started doing the posters. And so I have four of them on the wall. And the last most recent poster is from 2009, because the program last summer was canceled and we ended up with staff training and, you know, a little bit of fun and joy in the mountains. But anyway, 2009, and I'm looking at it, and it's got orienteering on it and picture of rock climbing, picture of us up there fishing, and then Sabbath services, and then a picture of eating in the rain. You know, two of the ladies are sitting there with tarps or something on, and the rain's coming down, and they got their cocoa in their hand. They're smiling, eating in the rain. You know, eating in the rain is uncomfortable. Just getting to where we had camp, frankly, is uncomfortable because we're base camped at about 10,000 feet. So it's 6 miles in and up to get there with a pack on your back. That's pretty uncomfortable. Getting eaten up by mosquitoes is uncomfortable. Sleeping on the ground is uncomfortable. Going to the bathroom in the woods is uncomfortable. It's all uncomfortable. That's why we were there. That's part of the point. People asked me years back when we first started going to Nigeria, and they'd say, well, why did you want to go to Nigeria? And my stock answer was, well, if I wanted to go to the mall, I would just stay home. I didn't go to Nigeria because of how nice it was there. The reason it was attractive to me, because it sounded like maybe it wasn't. That's why I wanted to go. I wish it was more noble than that. I just want to do the work, you know, I just want to serve God and His people. My intentions over the years have become more noble. Those are now my friends. And they're members of the body of Christ, and I am there to help and to serve them whichever way I can. We have relationships now. I have a commitment that's on a personal scale. I have a commitment to Dari to try to work with and serve and assist him to train and prepare and open doors for him to develop so that he can serve God's people. And we correspond back and forth, sometimes almost every day. He'll say, well, here's what happened, here's what I did, and I'll write back and say, okay, here's the context of what I believe we both understand. And so we do. We go back and forth in that way. So I have a very high level of commitment there. But honestly, I used to joke with Mr. Kellers. I said, well, you go to Nigeria because you're so noble, and I go to Nigeria because it's just a big adventure for me. And he says, oh, you're more noble than that. But the fact is, over time, my commitment has changed. They have a Challenger program in Nigeria, same as we have Challenger programs now here. And Dari has posted the adventures of their program on a website. And I go now and I can read, because these are people I know. I've spent time with them. I've ended a feast with them. I've sat at dinner with them. These are young people in some cases here that are being used and developing so that they can be of service to the church. This one is Mary, and Dari posted some of their experiences after the Challenger program they had last December. Now, Paul and I are going to the Challenger program this December. So when we get back, he can post his comments. Dara will have them up there, and we can read them as well. But Mary said, I wish to express my gratitude for the opportunity to be part of the Challenger 2009. It was indeed an unforgettable experience with lots of first-time memories. I remember how my primary challenge started a few minutes after we left the bus park, when the bus got stuck in traffic for more than 3 hours. The bus broke down in 3 states along the way, and we wasted hours almost the entire night on the roadside while they tried to do the repairs. During these unplanned circumstances, I was so surprised that none of the team members complained. I remember looking at Mr. Aquino on several occasions and was always surprised at his calmness every time I looked at him. The whole thing taught patience, and that's one thing I don't have. I plan things, and I don't appreciate when anything different from what I planned happens. Each time I grumbled, Yemisi is Tone's brother, was on the trip. Yemisi and Mary are now counseling for marriage. They actually had a chance to see each other in the wilderness of Nigeria under duress and see how they handled it. And Yemisi's commented, well, you know, I was really impressed. I was really impressed with the way she took discomfort and inconvenience. And he began to look at her then, not as a sister, as they would say over there, but as maybe someday as a mate. And it changed his perspective. But he says, each time I grumbled, Yemisi would tell me I owed him 20 naira. Like at home used to cost, what, 50 cents if you use the word board? We used to charge the kids. If they used the word board, we charged them. Works. It's impressively effective. Michelle one time had to even pay. What was it? We also charged for going to the bathroom at church. That way we didn't have to say you can't go. We just said, no, you can go all you want. Cost you a buck. You go to the bathroom. Want to go 10 times? 10 bucks. That's all. I don't care. You know, it's up to you. That worked pretty good, too. I collected from Michelle even on occasion. I don't know. There's different things. If you lean back in your chair, you had to stand up to finish dinner. I had to finish dinner standing up one time. I mean, there's ways to do this. But anyway, Yemisi told me I owed him 20 naira. He was referring to the piece Mr. Akinbo, Dari, sent some time ago with little grumbling to grateful. He gave an analogy and how to change our attitude. So I decided since it was costing me cash if I grumbled, I just didn't need to. So it's, you know, I mean, you look at this and you say, well, this is us too. We're all the same. We walk through the same things. Here's blessing. Blessing's also in the process of counseling for marriage. Again, you look at these and it's so exciting to see when you know them personally. She reflects that camping in an open place under the stars and sleeping in tents is something I've never experienced before, not to talk of on a cold mountaintop. Cut off from the usual busy life of the city, the entire camp area bathed in the light of the stars and the moon. I guess it's a foretaste of the peace of mind and tranquility one looks forward to in what our Lord Jesus Christ promised. I honestly couldn't really sleep on our first night on the mountain because of a number of factors. I was exposed in the wilderness, no safety of solid walls and a locked door or high fences. It is very common in Nigeria if you have a house or apartment complex, it's surrounded by a wall, a big iron gate, and on top of the wall is either steel spikes or broken glass that's been inserted into the cement around there so you can't just crawl up over the top. Very, very common. She says out in the wilderness there was no protection around the tent. She was out there in the open and exposed. She said, of course, especially the cold seeping into the tent, I don't know, probably got down to 70 or something. No, actually, I think it did get down into the 40s, and that's dramatic and remarkable. Some of the young people literally from Lagos had never been at that altitude and had that kind of discomfort in terms of the weather. They'd never experienced it before. And the cold seemed to laugh at the layers of clothing, the jackets, the stockings, and the face mufflers I had on. It was the coldest I've ever experienced. Thankfully, though, I later got used to it after the first night. You know, I read through these and I think, wow, what a blessing. Lola is Tone's sister, Dari's wife's sister. says the Wilderness Sabbath Service, encourage us to always make the best use of whatever we're dealt in life rather than wishing for something we don't have. It was a message that had sharpened my understanding of life, not to complain, but to smile and be grateful. Blooming where I am planted, playing with the cards I am dealt. Obviously, Dari's been reading Western novels and things and is using some of the analogies here. During this program, I gained a better understanding of the dynamism of God's creation. I learned deeper lessons that reflect on the importance of character, endurance, and the strengthening of our faith. Nosa is one day going to marry Blessing. And here's Nosa's comment that he made, or just, I'm pulling very small portions out. He says, as interesting events usually go, the days of the program quickly reeled to a close, and I almost before I knew it, it was time to go. As we walked back to the village where we were to catch a bus back to Joss City, I stayed toward the rear of the marching column of campers on purpose. Wanted to have a good view of everyone and store the image in my mind. That image, along with the entire experience, still resides strong in a tender place in my heart and continues to inspire me down to this day. You know, I just think that's a great blessing, God's gift, that He gave us, in some ways, challenge, in some ways, opportunity, a chance to see His creation, but in a way that at times, frankly, becomes uncomfortable. The poster that I was referring to, the 2009 poster, each poster has a scripture on it. And the scripture on that poster is Proverbs 24 and verse number 10. Proverbs 24 and verse number 10 says, if you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small. And it just fits. It fit what we were doing up there. There's a picture of Sabbath service with a Bible open, and on the side of the Bible is a mosquito. Somebody actually stopped and focused, and it was a great picture to show, look, you're sitting there, but even that isn't necessarily comfortable, but it is a rejoicing. And so we put on that poster, if you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small. Look at one of the times of trouble that was on the church in Acts chapter 8. It's described. I think it's helpful for us. And I think the context here sometimes maybe goes a little bit beyond what we sometimes assume. Acts 8 verse 1, Saul was consenting to Stephen's death. Stephen was killed. At that time, a great persecution arose against the church in Jerusalem. It says they were all scattered throughout the regions of Judea, Samaria, except the apostles. Now, that's a broad statement, and I'm assuming that the apostles weren't the last 12 or 13, depending on how you're counting those apostles, I guess with Judas gone as well. But, you know, Paul later came along. But it says they were all scattered. I take that as the church was principally scattered. I'm not convinced that every single person in Jerusalem had to leave. And it's interesting, too, on how some of the commentaries reference that. But it says, devout men carried Stephen to his burial and made great lamentation over him. As for Saul, he made havoc of the church, entering every house, dragging off men and women, committing them to prison. Now, in verse 4 it says, therefore those who were scattered went everywhere preaching the word. Now I addressed the gospel according to God, or the way that the scriptures show the gospel being preached. That's a different sermon. But notice it says Philip went down to the city of Samaria and preached Christ to them. Who's Philip? Philip is one of the Hellenistic Jews, one of the Hellenistic observers of God's law, meaning not of Jewish extraction racially, all right, from outside of Judea. And where did Philip's name first come up? Well, Philip's name first came up when they chose the deacons in Acts chapter 6. And why did they choose deacons? Because the widows, the Hellenistic widows, were not being cared for. So the fact is, the ladies who were Jews and lived in Jerusalem and had family network were kind of covered by that, but there was a group of people in Jerusalem who were not native to that area. Remember, they stayed after the day of Pentecost. The church, the people who came in to visit, stayed afterwards and took up residence for a time, and that's why they took offerings to help pay some of those expenses. Now, if you go back to Big Sandy, Texas, when we had a campus there, or you go to Pasadena, California, when we had a campus there, there were widows that literally took up residence in those areas because of the church there. And they'd go over and help in publishing, and they did the mailing and some of the envelope stuffing, and they did a lot of service through that area. So we had a church community grow up around those places. The exact same thing has happened in Cincinnati. Anytime you have a place where the church is headquartered or home office, as it is today, you're going to have church members gather around and want to be participating, want to be active, want to have access to it. And so what happened after Pentecost is these people stayed on. And they stayed on to help out, and but to be there. This is where it was happening. So now we have Philip going out, going to where? Samaria, a place where the Jews didn't generally go. And the multitudes with one accord heeded the things spoken by Philip, hearing and seeing the miracles which he did. Unclean spirits crying with a loud voice came out of many who were possessed. Many who were paralyzed and lame were healed, and there was great joy in the city. Now, essentially, what would appear to have happened, at least in large part, the people who came to be in Jerusalem and then stayed around and kind of set up housekeeping to be where the church and the work was being done, actually began to be persecuted. You see, the first people to be persecuted are the foreigners. It's the immigrants. It's the ones who are not accepted. It isn't the native people with friends and protected protections and relationships. So the first flood out the door would have been very heavily the Hellenistic members of the church. Philip was one of them. He went out, and yet he said, as a result, there was great joy in the city. Acts chapter 8 shows that Stephen was killed, all right? Is this the beginning of hard times? No, the hard times were yet to come. Persecution did not start with the death of Stephen. It started with the death of Jesus Christ. But this was still the good times. It says there was joy in that city, great joy. And so there was still much work that was able to be done. If you go to Luke 23, you want to have a contrast to when the hard times were going to begin. Christ told them clearly, Luke 23 and verse number 26. Here he is going to his death. Luke 23, 26. So it says, as they led him away, they laid hold of a certain man, Simon, a Cyrenian, who was coming from the country, and on him they laid the cross that he might bear it after Jesus. And great multitude of people followed him, and women who also mourned and lamented him. And Jesus turned to them and said, daughters of Jerusalem, don't weep for me. Weep for yourselves and for your children. Indeed, the days are coming in which they will say, blessed are the barren, the wombs that never bore, the breasts that never nursed. Then they will begin to say to the mountains, fall on us, or to the hills, cover us. For if they do these things in the greenwood, what will be done in the dry? He's saying, I'm dying, but these are not the hard times. These are the good times. The hard times are yet to come. If they do these things when the tree is green, what are they going to do when it's dry or dead? What kind of fire will be kindled when the wood is ready to be burned? So, again, brethren, these are the good times. The things that we walk through and have the opportunity to do are still here largely. The fact that our stove is fried is because of our prosperity, not because of our loss, our empty opportunity. It is because of the blessings, quite frankly, that we have received. Spokane is our home in a way that no other place has ever been. If I think of a place, where do I want to go back to? I think of Montana. But honestly, I was there as a child. And because I have family that is there in the summer and we have had a chance to visit from time to time, I think of Montana as a very special place. But if I think of home, we think of, Michelle and I, quite frankly, as Spokane in a way that no other place for us has ever been. Even without an oven, it's a nice place to be. I lived in four different cities before I even went to grade school. Before I went to grade school, I had lived in four different cities in a couple of different states. I lived in six different homes just in Medford, Oregon. Six different houses that we lived in one city. Now, that was before I left home. That doesn't count where I lived when I stayed there and left home or came back from the service. Those homes aren't even counted. When I look at the time we've spent here and the fact that we're still planting some trees. I'm planning to be around a while yet. We've been here more than twice as long as anywhere I've lived in this whole life, counting from birth. And so we look at Spokane as a very special place. I don't look at Spokane as the place where we will always get to be. I'd like to. I'd like to stop right here. I'd like to say, yeah, this is it. This far as we need to go. These are our friends. This is where God has allowed us to be, and we've been blessed, and I've worked, she's worked, we've planted, and the trees have grown. I'd like to enjoy that. I'd like to, when we finally get that stove fixed, I'd like to use it for a while, because it's going to probably be, who knows, if it takes $226 to fix the clock, imagine what that stove will cost before we're through. Matthew chapter 10, verse number 16. The apostles were sent out here, and Christ gave them instructions. But the instructions include prophecy that carries on down to our day, because we have a job that we do as well. But in Matthew 10, verse number 16, "Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore be wise as serpent and harmless as doves. Beware of men, for they will deliver you up to councils and scourge you in their synagogues. And you'll be brought before governors and kings for my sake as a testimony to them and to the Gentiles." Now these things happened to the apostles in that day, all right? They truly did. "When they deliver you up, don't worry about how or what you should speak. It'll be given to you in that hour what you should speak. For it is not you who speak, but the Spirit of your Father who speaks in you. Now brother will deliver up brother to death, and a father his child. And children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. You'll be hated by all for my name's sake, but he who endures to the end will be saved." Now, on one scale, you can say he who endures to the end of his life will be saved. And on the other scale, you can say, well, you know what? When we see the persecutions portrayed in the Bible, it shows the church being persecuted right up until the end then as well in some part. And we have to endure then. He who endures to the end will be saved. Part of this is prophetic of the end time. Part of it is specific to the day of the apostles themselves. Verse 23, "When they persecute you in this city, flee to another. Assuredly, I say to you, you will have not gone through the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes." Now that's very specific to the finish, the end time in our day. And it says that the time will come when we will be persecuted in one city and we will flee to another. And God says, you're not going to have gone through all the cities before Christ returns. Brethren, these are the good times. The struggles and trials and struggles that we now face, frustrations we now face, these are the good times. The hard times are yet to come. I was in a doctor's office this past week. It was an acupuncture doctor, and he was sitting at the desk, and I was there, and a man was sitting next to me, just three of us in the front lobby of the office. And I don't know how it came up, but it was an individual, the doctor had been in the Army. And somewhere in the course of the sitting there in the discussion, it came up, he had been in the Army, and the man that was next to me had also been in the Army, and he had been in Vietnam, and he made a couple of comments about Vietnam. And so then I followed up, and I commented on some of my buddies from Vietnam, and how when I finally got to meet them and saw how their lives were, that a number of them actually had stress disorder, PTSD, what used to be called kind of battle fatigue, and it's a little different, but it's similar. But it's the post-traumatic stress disorder. There's a stress disorder from all the troubles that they went through and faced, and then they came out of it. And it was hard to blend back into society in a way that didn't cause some distress when they returned. And I commented and I mentioned a couple of things that just descriptive of those circumstances. And the man turned to me, he says, "That's me, that's me." And he was so emphatic that I felt like, you know, what do you say? He's telling me that that stress and that struggle and those disorders is what followed him all through his life. Now, I came back from Vietnam in 1971. This is 2010. This man had been over there, I think, in 68. And he says, "That's me," he was referring to today. I felt bad. I had nothing that particular I could offer him. I couldn't give him some piece of advice. I frankly had no means or ability to even further engage. So I came back, I thought, well, you know, it's interesting. I see levels of stress rising among individuals in various places. Some of my friends in the church, even outside of these congregations, have expressed to me some of the stress that they're walking through as well. And so I looked up some of the symptoms of chronic stress. Not PTSD, just chronic stress. More than a bad day, all right, but stress on a continuing basis. Don't raise your hands, all right? I said, don't raise your hands. General fatigue and sleep problems, which means you're tired during the day and awake and restless at night. Anxiety and worry. Digestive problems, headaches, muscle tension, generally your neck and back or jaw, lowered immunity, your immunity system is compromised and it's easier to get sick, high blood pressure, hair loss, overeating, weight gain, drinking to relax, loss of concentration, fuzzy thinking, frustration, irritation, feeling overwhelmed, loss of joy in life, withdrawing from family and becoming less social. I said, don't raise your hands. Chronic stress. And it was a whole broad base of circumstance symptoms that I looked at. And I said, well, I see individuals in the church beginning to give evidence of increased levels of stress in their life. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to look up. Well, what does it say specifically? And I would have to say at the same time, let's keep in perspective, these are the good times. So we better handle the good times the best we can because the hard times are yet to come. And if the good times take us out, what will the hard times do? What will happen when it gets really bad? Ecclesiastes 9 is kind of dramatic in the way it describes how people live this life oftentimes. Ecclesiastes 9, verse number 3, says, "This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that one thing happens to all. Truly the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live." They live their lives like madmen in various ways. And after that, they die. But for him who's joined to all the living, there is hope. If you're still alive, there's hope. Hope for your neighbor, or if he is your enemy and you pray for him and becomes your friend. There's still a chance. A living dog is better than a dead lion. But I thought this is remarkable. There is an evil that is done under the sun. And it talks about the hearts of the Son of Men are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live. They do crazy things. I did crazy things. God called me out of doing crazy things. And basically said, stop it. And even after I was in the church and baptized, the process was an ongoing process. Well, I remember going home from work one day, out in the desert, working in a smelter, heading home to the ranch, lived in a trailer full of flies. And I'm heading down the road, 120 miles an hour in my Camaro, vroom, flying down the road. And there was a 90-degree curve up ahead where the road ended, the pavement kind of turns a corner and goes into dirt, catches the next road, heads on down. I better stop for the corner, you know, 120. Well, I stopped for the corner and slowed, and when I slowed down, my tire just completely disintegrated and came off. It had lost air somehow as in the course of me speeding and hitting something or puncturing it. But I was going so fast that it was keeping its shape. So when you slow down, there's no muffin left, there's no centrifugal force to keep that tire out there, and it just decomposed on me. Imagine if I hadn't slowed down, or if I just ran that little further, the sidewall was just getting ready to decompose. Well, I don't do that anymore. I don't. I remember being in Omaha, Nebraska, because we had a GMC van, and it had a digital display on the speeding, what do you call it, the odometer, or speedometer. Odometer is the mileage, speedometer is how fast you're going. And I remember one of the men got up after we made a trip to whatever the city was south of Omaha for a basketball weekend or something, and he had a sermonette, and he got up and he gave the sermonette the next week. And he said it was amazing to him because he looked over and saw the readout, the digital readout. And it said, back then, 55. And he just said he was impressed. Well, he should have been if he'd have known where I came from. I remember hitting a rabbit one time, and literally the rabbit's foot went completely through the tire. I always tried to imagine the rabbit was going like this just before I hit him, you know. But literally, when I stopped, you take the tire, and the rabbit leg went right through it. Well, let me just say, you just don't do that at 20. You've got to hit a rabbit really hard, going really fast, to put that bone right through your tire, and then have the wind whistle out through the middle. Well, I don't do that anymore. I don't. Been a long time since I did that, to be honest. Had to learn my lesson. Fortunately, I didn't learn it, you know, upside down in a car somewhere. Madness is in their hearts. Well, I certainly exemplified that. So I would say the first thing and the best way to minimize stress in our lives would be to minimize the circumstances that produce it. That would be the first call. You know, you put your hand up on the lectern and you hit it with a hammer and smash it, and then you come to me and said, take away the pain. I'm going to say, I'm sorry, I don't have control over those things. And you're going to say, well, what do I do now? Hurt? Just hurt now. Oh, take a couple of aspirin, that might help a little bit, but the fact is, if you put your hand up there, hit it with a hammer, you better just get ready to endure it for a while, because it's going to hurt for a long time. So I can't say, well, you do something that causes, in the madness of this life, that causes some big disaster. I can't necessarily say, well, here's how you solve it, take that away and neutralize the acid now in your life. It isn't necessarily that way. So there may be things to minimize it, but you might just have to take a little bit of focus on endurance. So the best way is obviously to minimize those mistakes that we make. Proverbs 27 and verse 12. Proverbs 27:12. You know, I just go back and I run that incident through in my mind. I was doing 90, not 120. My car would go 120, and I had done that, but I actually just crossed that. So let me at least have it accurate. We won't have to edit this. I was doing 90, and I slowed down. I'm sorry for mixing two stories together. I won't tell you about the other one. Some things just don't need to know. Proverbs 27, verse 12. A prudent man foresees evil and hides himself. The simple pass on and are punished. So what's our first defense against stress? Well, first defense against stress, or at least one defense, maybe not in order, but one defense would be wisdom. Use wisdom. Make decisions that are going to be fruitful and protect us, like don't leave the kitchen when there's mushrooms boiling on the stove until you're done or you've turned the stove down before you walk away. Psalm 19 would be another principle. Psalm 19 and verse number 7. pay attention to what God's law says and live your life within it. Live within the law. Psalm 19, verse 7, the law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold, yes, than much fine gold. Sweeter also than honey in the honeycomb. Moreover, by them your servant is warned. You see, the simple ignore the disaster coming and just walk right into the jaws. Moreover, by them your servant is warned, and in keeping them there is great reward. So use wisdom, avoid sin. That would be the first way, I would say, to argue against incorporating stress into our lives. 1 Corinthians 6 is a passage that actually talks about fornication or adultery, infidelity in some way, but the principle goes beyond that, 1 Corinthians 6 and verse number 19, because it's saying, well, you don't want to defile your body, because the body is what God gave you, and it's supposed to be the residue, it's supposed to be the temple of God's Holy Spirit, the container in which God is working. And so the principle then goes beyond just matters of sexual issue. 1 Corinthians 6:19 says, do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit, which is in you, whom you have from God, and you are not your own? The body is on loan, all right? And God gave it to us to serve Him and to do His will, not to do our own. For you were bought at a price. Therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. So, you know, if I loan something to someone, I can say, well, go ahead, you can borrow this, but I don't want you to do this with it or use it there or take it over here. I can actually say, well, here's what it is I'm giving you, but I want you to be careful in this way. You know, if you drive my car and I loan it to you, then I might say, okay, just make sure you keep it within the law, all right? Let's be careful in that way. So again, sexual immorality is the context, but it says glorify God in your body. Well, let's see, how do we do that? Well, how about taking care of the body in this flesh? Which would mean diet. Diet meaning what we eat, not necessarily diet in the sense of losing weight. Diet, health, exercise. The things that we do, the things we put in our mouth, the way we live this life, God says that's the temple of the Holy Spirit. Take care of that. Reduce your stress so that you don't get down the road a while and say, oops, man, I wish I hadn't done that. I did this all these years. I never did something that I should have done. So again, I cannot say once you smash your hand with the hammer, I can't say it's not going to hurt. It's going to hurt. It's going to hurt for a long time. If you don't take care of yourself physically, you might have problems that are not your fault. That will happen to many people. We are at the end of 6,000 years of genetic mutants. What do you call that when there's a fault in the DNA and mutations? And I've actually read some articles on that and how long it would take for the genetics to mutate to the point to where humanity would cease to exist. It's interesting. It's a rather short period of time. At the rate of mutation by who knows what process takes place. But you know, you get older and all of a sudden you get these flaky, scaly patches on your skin that dries out in some place, and your fingernails all of a sudden are no longer smooth. They have little ridges in them in some cases, and they get brittle and hard, and you can go through and start to show the little breakdowns of the body due to aging. Well, the fact is that's the reproductive ability of the body that is slowly going out of youthful vigor. The hormones no longer course in your body the way they used to. You know, all of those things are breakdowns and failures of certain things that are built in. You can say, well, God intended it that way. I don't know that He did. In some ways He did. Obviously, we're not eternal in this flesh. But look at Joshua. You know, look at Caleb. Look at the thing, Moses. Well, again, it's according to God's purpose, but I think when we're active in this life, generally speaking, if we're able to, and when we take care of ourselves in this life, you're still going to die, right? But the articles I've read on that as well say, well, what it is, you're going to take care of things and be generally mobile, and then you drop off very quickly at the very end. Now, that's certainly much better than a sliding, deepening scale of decline all through our life, which is what happens on the other side. Okay, I'm talking about where those options are available. Do what we can with what we have to do. It's the temple. It reduces our stress down the road. Glorify God in our bodies. Our responsibility before God is to orient our lives, to do good, to lift up and encourage those around us as well, and to be productive, to bear much fruit. At the very same time, we're to resist evil. In fact, we're to overcome evil with good. Psalm 4, verse number 1, talks about the concept here, looking to God, trusting God, not being over-anxious or worrying beyond reasonable measure. But Psalm 4, verse 1, hear me when I call, O God of my righteousness. You have relieved me when I was in distress. Have mercy on me and hear my prayer. How long, O you sons of men, will you turn my glory to shame? How long will you love worthlessness and seek falsehood? Kind of live this life in a form of madness. And know that the Lord has set apart for himself him who is godly. The Lord will hear when I call to him. Be angry, but do not sin. Meditate within your heart on your bed and be still. Offer the sacrifices of righteousness and put your trust in the Lord. There are many who say, who will show us any good? Lord, lift up the light of your countenance upon us. You have put gladness in my heart more than in the season that the grain and wine increased. It goes beyond physical satisfaction or joy. It's something that God does for us in our own mind. I will both lie down in peace and sleep, for you alone, Lord, make me to dwell in safety. You know, this isn't describing a place that you just arrive at. It's describing a process, a journey in that sense, on where we always have to be going. And yes, we arrive there incrementally, but not all at once. It's the place where we need, though, to be. Philippians 4. Well, what is it that we should meditate on and lie down that will give us the opportunity to achieve that kind of peace? Philippians 4 and verse number 8. Brethren, says, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, lie down in your bed, you know, and meditate. I will give you rest. Whatever things are pure and things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there's any virtue, if there's anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. Fill your mind with them. Fill your heart in terms of the emotional context. The things which you learned and received and heard and saw in me, these do, and the God of peace will be with you. So we have responsibility. It doesn't say they won't be driven out of Jerusalem, but it says there'll be joy in Samaria. All is not lost. Brethren, these are the good times compared to the bad ones yet to come. We need to use them well. People who have been through the Depression, some of our older members, remember hard times, and we've all probably heard various stories about that. But that was an agrarian society, by and large. What the people did not have was cash, hard cash. What generally they had was food. It wasn't a matter of if they could have something to eat necessarily. I'm not saying that no one ever went without. You know, the Dust Bowl was a hard time. You couldn't grow anything, and people literally migrated, moved out to the West Coast and up into the orchards of California and Washington and Oregon and worked in those areas to survive. But again, it was hard cash that they were missing, but it generally wasn't food. Anybody here have a hard time getting their hands on a turkey this week? Or part of a turkey? We didn't even have an oven. We cooked a 20-pound turkey on the counter. Well, didn't light the counter on fire, but, you know, we got a broaster, and we were able to cook our turkey. We had no problem. I had not only picked up the turkey for us to eat, I picked up a few more and fresh ones and threw them in the freezer. I doubt anybody here had a hard time finding a piece of turkey on Thanksgiving if that's what you chose to eat. These aren't the hard times. They're not even there yet. Matthew 24, again, goes back to the context here, remembering, recognizing, understanding what it is that hard times really are going to be. Matthew 24 and verse number 3. As he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately. He said, "Tell us, when will these things be? What will be the sign of your coming in the end of the age?" Jesus answered and said to them, "Take heed that no one deceives you. Many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will deceive many." False Christianity over time. "You'll hear of wars and rumors of wars, that you're not, see that you're not troubled. All these things must come to pass. The end is not yet. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. Famines, pestilence, and earthquakes will be in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you'll be hated by all nations for my name's sake. Then many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. And many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end will be saved." It's not talking about the world in particular, because it's talking about he who endures to the end will be saved. Therefore, when it says lawlessness will abound and the love of many will grow cold, the love that grows cold includes the church, because that's the finish here in the context. And the answer is, he who endures to the end shall be saved. We're not there to the point where we're being persecuted yet. We're not there to the point where we have to flee and go from city to city in order to continue to serve God and to do his work to the degree he allows us. These are the good times. Somebody asked me recently if I thought that some in the church, the love of some in the church, had begun to grow cold. I said, "Well, it appears so. It appears like a process that seems to be starting. Some of the church members, their love for one another has begun to grow cold. They're beginning to treat their friends as enemies." The sermonette played that out incredibly well. I thought it was very descriptive. They begin to revile and speak evil against their leaders and their friends and their brothers, because we're a family. Romans 12, the only way I can understand that is if the love of some begins to grow cold. Romans 12, verse 9. "Let love be without hypocrisy," which means if you say, "I love you," then let your actions give evidence of that. Don't pretend to be one who loves, but not actually love in response. That would be hypocrisy. "Abhor what is evil, cling to what is good. Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love, in honor giving preference to one another, not lagging in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, continuing steadfastly in prayer, distributing to the needs of the saints, given to hospitality. Bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse." There are people in the church now that are actually a form of cursing, slandering people who aren't even their persecutors. They're their brethren. They're part of their family. This says those who persecute us, bless and do not curse. "Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Be of the same mind toward one another. Don't set your mind on high things, but associate with the humble. Don't be wise in your own opinion." A plague of which has descended on the church. "Repay no one evil for evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. And if it's possible, as much as it depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Don't avenge yourself. Rather give place to wrath. As it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, says the Lord. Therefore, if your enemy hungers, love your enemy. Feed him. If he thirsts, give him a drink. In so doing, you will heap coals of fire on his head because of his own accountability to God, not to you. Don't be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. I don't know how much clearer it could be said. Overcome evil with good. Luke 12 has a very interesting passage as well. And I have to say, I've never quite looked at it in this context, but now, in the circumstances that are playing out around us, it seems fairly clear to me. Luke 12, it says, Christ here says, beware, toward the end of verse 1, of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. Because they act like they care and they really don't. They act like they're religious and serving God and they really aren't. There is nothing covered that will not be revealed, nor hidden that will not be known. Therefore, whatever you have spoken in the dark will be heard in the light. What you have spoken in the ear in inner rooms will be proclaimed on the housetops. Now, how exactly does that take place? Did that take place in the time of the apostles? Did it take place all through the centuries, through the Dark Ages? Did it take place when the United States was founded as a nation? When did it take place? It took place now on the Internet. It's never happened until the Internet was available. And this is so interesting. It says here, whatever you've spoken in the dark will be heard in the light. It's going to be put on there and published and sent around the world. This sermon is going out who knows where, and every single word I speak I have to give account for now, not just in the congregation, but to whoever is listening, wherever they may be. And it will travel out in various ways around this world. I thought, that's amazing. The time is going to come when everything that is said, even spoken into the ear, is going to be proclaimed from the housetops. I mean, that's happening today. I've never known of a time or circumstance where that could be fulfilled previous to our own day. And yet God says, look, don't get so caught up in worry and anguish that we lose perspective. These are the good times. Rejoice. Be thankful. Plant a crop. Reap a harvest. Deal with the struggle and stress and the loss, but go forward. Don't be looking back. Psalm 37 says, don't fret. Doesn't solve the issue, doesn't change anything. Psalm 37, verse 5, commit your way to the Lord, trust also in Him, and He shall bring it to pass. He shall bring forth your righteousness as the light, and your justice as the noonday. In part, it's referring to the resurrection, is it not? Rest in the Lord and wait patiently for Him. Do not fret because of him who prospers in his way, because of the man who brings wicked schemes to pass. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Do not fret. It only causes harm. It's not going to help us in any way. Again, this is a process. It's a direction. It's not a place that we arrive at and stay. It's something that we work towards as we go in this Christian life. You know, I don't think you have to be real bright to know kind of what the rules are, what's going on, and where things are headed. Last spring, in talking to a couple of friends of mine who were displeased with this or that or something else, and I told them, I said, well, what good is it going to be when there's a home office in Ohio and a headquarters in Texas? How are we going to go to God when there's a headquarters in Texas and we have our home office in Ohio and justify to Him why that took place? Now, I didn't announce that in a sermon, but I did. I told last spring, related that to a few friends, and said, I don't think we're going to be able to justify that when it happens. GCE last May, I was sitting there at the GCE. I'm watching everything go on, looking at what's stated, watching the relationships, things that people say. And I sat and I wrote in my notes at the GCE in May, and I wrote down, we shot ourselves in the stomach 2 years ago and barring healing, we lay dying. I wrote that in my notes in May. So it's not like when I look around, I see something taking place, I'm going, oh, shock me. It's not shock me. It's what's been in process. I lament that it's in process the way it is. I lament the decision some individuals are making. But brethren, these are the good times. We still have the 20-pound turkeys that we can throw in the broaster when the oven breaks down and have 12 people over and rejoice and give thanks to God for the blessings we have received. We still have church and a congregation and the fact that Idahoans didn't get much snow. And we can collect over here and park in the lot and be together and encourage each other and have nice clothes and good things and our bellies filled. And this is the good times. Rejoice, brethren, in the good things. There is certainly some trouble, but it's not like we just woke up and found out that it was this way. It's a process. Don't be confused. Take the blessings and the opportunities that are here and use them well. Be thankful, be diligent, be fruitful. These are the good times.